Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour, what can nature teach us about how to build better societies?
Then we explore a unifying theory for science and humanity.
Last month, the great scientist, public servant, and environmentalist Rafe Sagrin was killed while riding his bicycle. He was hit by a drunk driver. Sagrin was 43 years old. In honor of his great work, we revisit the 2012 conversation we had with Rafe Sagrin on the Scholar Circle about his book, Learning from the Octopus.
What can nature teach us about organizing our societies, governments, and businesses? Our next guest says a lot. The creatures in nature, he says, have been living and thriving in a risk-filled planet for billions of years and have survived some of the deadliest conditions by constantly adapting to the challenges, by decentralizing their responses, by cooperating with unlikely partners, and changing as a result. Rafe Sagrin is a marine ecologist and environmental policy analyst, as well as a research scientist at the Institute of the Environment at the University of Arizona. He's also author of Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. It's great to have you with us, Rafe Sagrin. Let's start with your fundamental premise, which seems to be that nature really has a lot of important lessons for us, no matter what kinds of things we're organizing in society.
Any situation where there's uncertainty and some kind of risk in the environment, which we all deal with, are areas where we can learn from natural evolution and adaptation, because that's what natural organisms are dealing with, 3.5 billion years of total uncertainty in a risk-filled world. So it can be national security, but it can also be how you're going to get your business through the next economic cycle, or how you're dealing with a group of at-risk kids in a classroom. It's really any time you have a situation that has a high degree of uncertainty.
Your prologue was so interesting, where you talk about late December 2006 when the animals started to act really funny and they started running to higher ground and refusing to walk on the beach.
Yeah.
And then an hour later, we had that awful tsunami that killed 225,000 people. And you point out that the animal-based system worked where our man-made tsunami warning system failed.
Exactly. So animals basically are much better alarm systems than anything humans created. You just had an article that I commented on in the LA Times on the BioWatch alarm systems, which are billion-dollar alarm systems that are totally failing everywhere, giving lots of false alarms and creating all this uncertainty. But animal systems work because they have such an intensive observational sense of the world and how it changes and how it usually changes, and then they can pick up on these subtle changes far earlier than most humans.
Is this primarily keener senses? You've talked about observation and keen observation being really important.
Yeah.
But animals, of course, do have these keener senses. What is the explanation?
Well, in some cases, it's having keener senses. Some of them may have a magnetic sense. They may have keener chemical senses, but it's also just the practice of observing makes you a better observer. And that's what my newer book, Observation and Ecology, is about, how the practice of continually observing complex systems like the natural world makes you a better observer and allows you essentially a predictive capacity. Although organisms don't really predict the future, you can essentially get a sense of what fits into a pattern and what doesn't fit into a pattern, and that allows you to exploit new opportunities. And you can see this in human athletes as well. The best human athletes, not coincidentally, also happen to be the ones that practice the most. So you would think, you know, someone like Michael Jordan or Wayne Gretzky would be done with practice because they're so good. Well, they're the ones who practice the longest, the hardest, and what they're doing is essentially training their brain to make predictions based on patterns.
This would go into the chapter you talk about learning and the different kinds of learning. And learning you call a force of nature, almost like gravity.
It is. It's impossible to be in the world and be observing the world, especially the way that wild organisms do, and not learn. And that's the real danger of spending so much time inside, spending so much time in front of our screens, is that we're learning in a much less complex world. There's just no way about it. A binary system like a computer is much less complex than a natural system. and you're essentially dulling down the learning process, which is why I talk a little bit in Learning from the Octopus and a lot in the book Observation and Ecology about how we've got to get our kids back out into nature and put the screens down and push them out there and let them solve their own problems out there.
Let's talk about some of these kinds of learning. One is this kind of interaction with the environment. One might be, you said, even encoded in DNA passed from, you use the mother sea otter to pup, and the kind of combined learning that is important and how that manifests in nature versus what we deal with as humans.
Yeah, exactly. So you get learning essentially just from passing down your genes. It's essentially intergenerational learning, and then you learn during your lifetime. Now, in both cases, in nature, I say that the most important learning, the learning that really gets you somewhere, is learning from your past successes. So every single organism in nature is an example genetically of learning from its ancestors' successes, but they also have to learn from their successes what things work, what tactics work, what behaviors worked, and replicate those during their lifetimes. We tend to do a lot of focus in society on learning from failure. So we focus intently on what we did wrong. We have all sorts of after-action reports and meetings in our business about everything we did wrong. And there's a lot in the business literature these days that suggests it's sort of clever to learn from your mistakes or learn from failures. And it sounds sort of self-effacing. But in fact, learning from failure in nature is a dead end. It means you die. It means you don't reproduce. Learning from success is the process of building on something that works and then building something even better off of that platform. And the example I give in the book, Hurricane Katrina, sure, there were a lot of failures that we wanted to learn from and not repeat, and I certainly don't say that we should ignore them. But in all the after-action report on Hurricane Katrina, which identified over 100 different failures, they didn't talk at all about the most important success, which was a Coast Guard containing 9 million gallons of oil spilled. And it turns out that that one success is exactly the one thing you needed to learn from for the next big Gulf disaster, which was the Deepwater Horizon. So by being so focused on the failures and having no focus on the successes, government missed a really good opportunity to learn from what it takes to clean up, in this case, oil in a logistically compromised situation.
One thing I was wondering as you were talking about and writing about learning from the ancestors is people who have gone through really traumatic things, say Holocaust survivors, genocide survivors, war survivors, do you think that their offspring learn something that is not necessarily adaptive to a society that's not at war?
No, I don't think so. I think that when you're surviving in completely novel, horrific situations, that's when your natural adaptive capacities really kick in. And by telling those stories, how did I survive this war? How did I survive through the Holocaust? You essentially provide a way for your offspring or people in your community to learn from those successes. That's why I give several stories of young officers and soldiers who have been fighting for 10 years now in Iraq and Afghanistan. These people are coming back. They have been incredibly adaptable in how they survived over there. And there's two things that we really need to focus on with this population. One is ensuring that they're healthy and that they're getting through the stress and physical debilities that they have. But the second is that everyone, if they own a business, if they're in government, if they're in a nonprofit, should be snapping up these young men and women because they are the brain trust of how to be adaptable in the world. They have incredible ideas, and they have it sort of built into their system now of how to be adaptable, and they can use those skills in peacetime. They can use them in civilian jobs. So I say, you know, it's not just a patriotic duty to hire a veteran. It's really going to benefit your organization to bring these people in.
I'm going to want to go back to that whole idea of adaptability, since that's one of the big focuses of your book. But before I do, I want to stick to the learning thing for a moment. There's also an idea among teachers about unlearning things that are bad, unlearning a bad habit, unlearning a mistake. Where does that come in? Because if you practice a bad behavior or a bad mistake,
it just becomes part of your learning process.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just back east visiting my parents and driving up Route 8 in Connecticut, and I was brought back to my childhood where every time we drove up this complicated intersection on Route 8, my mom would take the wrong exit, and she would say, "I know it's the wrong exit every time I do it," and she just had it built into her brain to go off on the wrong lane. So I've been thinking about that, and certainly you can reinstill learning of bad habits, which is why you have to go back to this process of being keenly aware of your environment, because it's your environment and the changes that in your environment that sort of dictate what's going to work and what's not going to work there. So that's the way you sort of break out of that cycle.
So let's talk about some of these creatures that you look at, like the title of your book, Learning from the Octopus, that perhaps we can take guidance from the living world about how society can actually function and function well. One of the major issues is adaptability. And you talk about the octopus as a very important creature to watch and how it adapts. Give us some examples.
Yeah, the octopus is a great metaphor for how we can use adaptability, because the octopus demonstrates so many of the characters of adaptable systems as a whole. And surprisingly, the octopus is not that much different from us in the sense that it has a very good central brain or central controller. It has a cognitive mind, really, and a lot of people don't know that. But octopuses are smart, clever. They can create things. They can make and use tools. They think about the future. And yet, the octopus doesn't use that wonderful central brain when it really needs to adapt quickly. For example, if it needs to change color quickly, it doesn't have its brain yell to arm one, turn purple, and then arm two, turn green, and arm three, turn kind of purplish blue. Rather, it has millions of individual skin cells spread all along its body that each individually respond to the changes that those skin cells perceive in the environment. And that, as a whole, collectively, gives the octopus its camouflage. So the octopus has a brain which it can use, but it also shuts down that brain almost, or lets go of that central control in order for all those localized agents, all those individual skin cells, to respond and adapt to the environment. And that's a key metaphor, because a lot of the adaptable solutions I talk about require letting go of some of that central control, stopping the process of giving orders and switching to a process of issuing challenges where you say, here's a problem we're facing. Anyone go out and solve this problem. And that activates all these individuals who can collectively come up with solutions that help us adapt. And you can do that kind of octopus-like camouflage or octopus-like problem solving in any kind of organization.
So it is an argument for decentralization.
It is. I suggest that it's, like I say, have an open mind, but not so open your brain falls out.
Right.
There is also a role for the central controller, but it may be different than what the role is right now that we see in a lot of organizations and a lot of businesses and a lot of governments.
I learned so much about the octopus from reading your book and really wanted to hear you describe a little bit of the activities that it takes on. You mentioned that the tool building before, but there are all these other things about the ink that it can spray out and then how it still can change one side of itself to attract a mate while changing the other side to warn others off.
Yeah, and this is another key theme that makes the octopus a great central metaphor, is it does so many different things to solve problems. And I talk about this as a process of creative redundancy that's also very common in nature. We tend to think of redundancy as wasteful or inefficient, but in fact, redundancy gives you multiple different ways of solving problems because, once again, you can't really predict what the next problem is going to be. So an octopus can jet away in a cloud of ink. It can camouflage itself. It can bite an enemy. It can squeeze itself into a tiny, tiny crevice. Once, years ago, my old advisor, Chuck Baxter, when he got married in Monterey Bay, threw a wine bottle, a champagne bottle, over the boat that he got married on. And about 5 years later, he was diving and saw the same wine bottle with an octopus stuffed inside. So an octopus can squeeze itself through the neck of a wine bottle, which is quite amazing.
Could it get out?
Oh, yeah, sure. So it's incredibly flexible, and it has this great brain that I mentioned. So the octopus has been shown to utilize new things in its environments. There's an octopus video that shows an octopus has learned to take the halves of coconuts that tourists throw overboard in a South Pacific island, and it grabs them, takes them back to its lair, and later can use those two halves of a coconut and wrap itself up in them and use it as a kind of suit of armor.
So this was one of the examples of adaptability, which is what you argue we're missing in some of our human bureaucratic states.
We see it especially in businesses now. There's this endless pursuit of efficiency, and we think by getting rid of redundancy, often in the form of firing people, that we're going to become more efficient. But that misses the larger picture. We become less adaptable as we become less redundant in this way. I know a businessman who's very successful. He runs a manufacturing business, and he bases his whole business on biological principles. And one of the things he was proudest to show me was an entire warehouse he had of spare parts. And he said, none of my competitors would ever waste a whole warehouse on spare parts. They're all about just-in-time manufacturing, very efficient. And yet, when any one of my clients needs one of these parts, I'm the only one who has them. So I can charge anything for them, and I can, you know, mark up whatever I want, and then customers come back to me because they know I'm the only one who has what they need. So he's looking at the much bigger picture, even though it's inefficient to house all those spare parts.
The other, I thought, really key point in your book that you draw from nature again is the idea of symbiosis and cooperation. You said that it appears in nature even in the most unlikely situations. What are some of those?
The amazing thing about symbiosis is indeed that sometimes organisms that you think would have nothing to do with one another develop these partnerships. And there are examples everywhere in nature. For example, cleaner wrasses are small fish that clean the teeth of much larger predatory fish. And what's amazing that we're just learning now is that these symbiotic partnerships often have what we call emergent properties, or things that you wouldn't expect from the relationship of the two organisms. So we're learning now that these larger predatory fish are much less aggressive to all the fish in that reef patch when they're being cleaned by these cleaner wrasses. And we see that the most effective symbiotic partnerships in humans often come, again, between groups of humans or individuals that you would never expect to work together. And I talk in the book about a partnership of Israeli, Palestinian, and Jordanian health practitioners who are all working together to solve the problem of infectious diseases, no matter what side of whatever disputed territories they arise in. Now, one of the important things about this partnership is, and I talk about how natural systems do not aim for perfection. They just try to solve problems. These partnerships between the Israelis, Palestinians, and Jordanians are not trying to create peace in the Middle East. That is not their goal. They don't put that forward as their goal. They're trying to solve the immediate problem of infectious diseases. And by focusing intently on that immediate problem, they've created a very strong partnership. Now, that partnership may result in the first steps towards peace in the Middle East, but they don't put that as a goal. Just like natural organisms and natural systems do not have goals. They do not have a plan, a long-term plan. They're just trying to solve the challenges in the environment. So when you want to create a symbiotic partnership, first of all, it doesn't matter who you want to create it with. You could create it with anyone. But secondly, you want to look at what is the problem we can solve by working together, not, oh, it'd be a great idea for us to work together.
There were other aspects, too, like the evolution of some of these symbiotic relationships. They transform from one to another. You said some viruses start out parasitic, later become harmless.
Absolutely. That's another thing we're learning about symbiotic partnerships, is that they can transform. And many symbiotic partnerships that are around today used to be conflictual relationships between organisms or competitive relationships.
And the other aspect I thought was really interesting and important in this is that things are always changing. The symbiosis is always changing. The environment is always changing. And that nothing is really going to stay the same.
All the good naturalists, going back to Darwin, recognize that change is another sort of force of nature, something that you just can't deny, that the world is always changing. And that's exactly at the core of why anyone needs to be adaptable, because whatever you do now may not be what you need to do to solve the problems of the future. And the problems of today may be totally different than the problems of tomorrow. And the only way to deal with that, because you can't predict every possible change that could occur in a complex world, the only way to deal with it is to become adaptable.
Now, you noted that one researcher, when he was looking at these kinds of relationships, he saw them decidedly pointing away from conflict and warfare.
This is an early naturalist and ecologist, people like Warder Ali, who was at the University of Chicago, and then his student, Ed Ricketts, who is pretty well known to people on the West Coast. He was a good friend of John Steinbeck's, and he appears in a number of Steinbeck's novels. These early naturalists really didn't see any difference between the natural world and human societies, and they thought that lessons could easily be transposed across from the natural world to society. And some of them were working in the period between wars, and they were trying to figure out what can we learn from nature about conflict and about getting rid of conflict. And one of the things, especially that Ali was focused on, was cooperation among organisms. And he felt that the natural tendency, not necessarily within an organism's lifetime, but through generations, the natural tendency was towards cooperation, that even relationships that were conflictual now would evolve into cooperative relationships, and that it was a continual cycle, that they would go back, there would be new conflicts that would arise, and those too would also ultimately transform into cooperative relationships. So it wasn't a one-way pathway by any means, it was a cycle. But it was a cycle that where cooperation continually trumped conflict.
Of course, you're a scientist, but you also worked in Congress. Did you talk about any of these things when you were in Congress, when you were working
there? No, it was actually my own adaptation and my own movement. I say that adaptation is about leaving or being forced from your comfort zone, and that happened to me. My comfort zone was always working in the tide pools of the Pacific Coast, but I found myself, after 9/11, way outside of my comfort zone, working as a science advisor to Congresswoman Hilda Solis, who's now the Labor Secretary in Washington, D.C. And it was my observations, essentially being a naturalist of the world of Washington, D.C., since I didn't have tide pools to look at, those observations led me to think about a better way to do security, because what I was seeing was security going up everywhere. I stole Mike Davis's title from his book about L.A., An Ecology of Fear, to describe Washington, D.C. after 9/11. It was an ecology of fear. There was new signs of security everywhere, but they always stayed the same. So new metal detectors everywhere, but the procedures never changed. And we learned very quickly, we adapted very quickly as staffers on the Hill to figure out how you get around these metal detectors so you didn't have to take your keys out of your pocket, things like that. And I thought, if staffers, to avoid a little inconvenience, can figure out how to get through these security systems, an adaptable organism like a terrorist certainly could figure that out. So that led me to start thinking about these things and thinking about all the ways that organisms adapt to deal with a changing environment.
And then two contentions I had with the argument, kind of challenges, not really contentions, I should say. One is, you suggest essentially that bureaucracies are not really changing. But I would argue that they are changing, even if they change slowly.
Certainly. I mean, everything changes, and bureaucracies can change. What I'm suggesting is not that we have to completely eliminate these bureaucracies, get rid of the Department of Homeland Security, and start over again. It's nice when you can create an adaptable system out of nothing, like Google was created as an adaptable company. But I show through examples of even some very traditional companies like 3M and very traditional bureaucracies like the Department of Defense that there are people working within those organizations and figuring out ways to be adaptable. So you can start creating adaptable systems anywhere. You don't have to take the whole thing down and rebuild it. Again, nature doesn't aim for or try to be perfect. You just have to solve the problems. And the way you do it is by starting to issue these challenges in any part of an organization. And I show how 3M, for example, did that brilliantly when they wanted to reduce their environmental footprint. They didn't have the CEO say, everyone recycle 20% more as an order. They issued a challenge and said, anyone in this organization who can help us reduce our environmental footprint, give us your ideas. And they had over 8,000 different successful ideas that were implemented that massively reduced their environmental footprint, saved the company millions and millions of dollars, and didn't cost the company anything. All people got for participating in this challenge was like a certificate of achievement. The remarkable thing about issuing challenges is that people will rise to the occasion. They are empowered and excited to help solve a problem. And it takes very little motivation, financially or otherwise, a little bit, but it always turns out to be much less than you would expect. And it always turns out to be much cheaper, and you get results much more quickly than the order-based mentality where an expert or a small group of experts tells everyone else what to do and expects them to follow it.
And then finally, as I was reading the book and I sat it down to just sort of think about it, I thought, well, there's so much that you are right about in terms of there's so much in the natural environment and the adaptability and things that we have sort of lost. And then at the same time, I thought human beings are the ones that are surviving the most of all the other creatures.
And we are an incredibly adaptable species. And in some ways, that has gotten us 99.9% of the way, but we're starting to see where all that adaptability that allowed us essentially to insulate ourselves from the daily struggle to survive, and I always put a caveat that there's still a billion people in this world who don't get enough to eat every day, which means that they are still in the tooth and claw world of surviving every day. But for the rest of us, we've insulated ourselves to some extent from the daily pressures, and that sort of dulled our adaptive senses, just as I talk about spending so much time in front of our screens and indoors is dulling our observational senses, which allow us to be adaptable. And so the book is really a call to get back a little bit of that adaptability that we used to have. And again, we see it where modern humans are put in situations of heavy stress, where they have to be adaptable, like the soldiers and Marines who have spent 10 years fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan have become very adaptable again.
Well, great. Thank you so much for being with us. The book, again, is called Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. And we've been speaking with Rafe Sagarin. Thank you so much, Rafe.
Thank you.
Last month, the great scientist and environmentalist Rafe Sagarin was killed while riding his bicycle. Sagarin was 43 years old.
When we come back, we explore the system's view of life with Fritjof Capra. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Fritjof Capra is a theoretical physicist who has taught at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and Berkeley. He is now on the faculty of Schumacher College and the founder of the Center for Ecoliteracy in Berkeley, California. Capra has authored The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, The Hidden Connections, and his latest, The Systems View of Life, which seeks to put forward a unifying theory for science and humanity. We began our conversation last week by phone about the basic ideas behind systems theory.
Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Fritjof Capra. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Your new book, The Systems View of Life, A Unifying Vision, first takes on the old conception of the universe and how it contrasts with the systems view of life. Let's start with the old view. How would you describe that?
Well, the old view is a view that was created in science during the scientific revolution in the 17th century by Galileo, Descartes, Bacon, Newton, and it is a mechanistic view of the world. It sees the world essentially as a machine made of fundamental building blocks. It also sees the mind as fundamentally separated from matter. Mind and matter, according to Descartes, belonging to two different and separate realms. And there are many other components or other characteristics of this worldview, but those are some of the principal ones. And we are shifting now to a new view that has recognized that the material world ultimately is a network of inseparable patterns of relationships. We also have discovered that the planet as a whole is a living, self-regulated system. And correspondingly, the view of the human body as a machine and of the mind as a separate entity is being replaced by one that sees not only the brain, but also the immune system, the bodily tissues, and even each cell as a living cognitive system. So those are the essential elements. If you want to put it in one sentence, then I would say that the paradigm shift we are going through now is a fundamental change of metaphors from seeing the world as a machine to understanding it as a network.
So as a network of interconnected and interdependent organisms?
Not only organisms, because as quantum theory has shown us, it starts with the material world, interconnected particles, atoms, molecules, cells. Cells, of course, are organisms, but also interconnected social systems and ecosystems. And one of the key discoveries in the 20th century has been that the main pattern of this interconnectedness is the network pattern. So cells are networks of molecules, organisms are networks of cells, societies or communities are networks of communications, ecosystems are networks of feeding relationships, and wherever you see life, you see networks.
And universes being networks of planets and stars?
Well, we don't go that far because we can say from a scientific point of view that the Earth, the planet as a whole, is alive. That's the so-called Gaia theory. And that is definitely a network of organisms, especially bacteria, which span a planetary communications network. But then beyond the Earth, we cannot say scientifically that the solar system or the universe are living systems.
You started to talk about in the subatomic levels. And there are some really fascinating aspects of these subatomic behaviors, and these contradictory properties that you talk about in your book. Other physicists have demonstrated.
Right.
For example, electrons behaving like particles sometimes, but sometimes waves. How can we understand this, and how does it fit into your new systems theory?
Well, we have to transcend this classical view of matter being made of separate building blocks. There's no such thing at the subatomic level. Obviously, in everyday life, it works very well. We can take apart machines, we can analyze plants and see, you know, various molecules, we can see cells, and, you know, to some extent, those are independent. But fundamentally, there are no such things as independent basic building blocks. It's all networks. And so when we interact with these networks, we change them. And at the subatomic level, these changes are so dramatic that we can interact with an electron in one way, putting it through one kind of experimental apparatus, and it will show properties of a particle. But when we put it through another kind of apparatus, it will show properties of a wave. In other words, the electron is neither a particle nor a wave, but it gives us particle answers if we ask it a particle question. It gives us wave answers if we answer it a wave question. And the fundamental lesson is that everything is interconnected, including the human observer and our methods of observation.
Then there's this aspect of matter itself and whether or not it occurs with certainty in definitive times and places.
Yes, well, that is I have given you sort of the philosophical answer to the question, how can an electron be a particle and a wave? But there's also a technical answer involving a mathematical formalism, and that formalism is probability theory. And at the subatomic level, we have discovered we can never say with certainty where a particle would be or how it would behave. We can only give it probabilities. And so we can say that matter does not exist with certainty in various places at various times, but shows what Heisenberg has called tendencies to exist. And those tendencies in technical language are probabilities. The great physicist Niels Bohr, one of the founders of quantum theory, has said, if you hear this for the first time and are not confused, you haven't understood anything. They were all confused, all these physicists. But I should also say that this theory, quantum theory, is now a well-established theory and has worked magnificently, you know, for 100 years almost.
We've also had quite a few conversations with other physicists, including Michio Kaku, who co-authored the superstring theory.
Right.
Do you address that at all within your systems view?
Well, I did, but, you know, our book is 500 pages long, and the original manuscript was 600 pages. So that whole section of string theory had to be cut out. And I was so fascinated by it that I posted it on my website. So if you go to my website, fritjofkapra.net, you will find a blog on called The Unification of Physics. And there I talk about string theory and these more recent theories.
And can you give us a sense of what that chapter addresses
approaches? It's really difficult to summarize in a few words because the basic challenge is to unify four fundamental natural forces, the forces of electromagnetism that hold atoms together and are the basis of chemistry, then the nuclear force that holds the nucleus together, and then the so-called weak force that governs radioactive decay and processes like this, and gravity. And so over the last 50 years, physicists have succeeded in unifying three out of those four forces, and the theory has worked so well, especially with the recent almost certain discovery of the Higgs boson. The theory has worked so well that it is known among physicists as the standard model, which shows you, you know, it's well established. But what they have not been able to do is to add gravity to this unification. And this is what string theory tries to do. It is a very elegant theory expressing the properties of elementary particles in terms of vibrations of multidimensional strings. The big drawback of the theory is that in spite of its great elegance and beauty, it's not really a scientific theory because it has so many parameters that are arbitrary that you can produce almost any result. And that's not good for a scientific theory. Scientific theory is supposed to be predictable. I mean, to have predictive power, and that string theory doesn't.
So in terms of contrasting or integrating it with the systems view, can that be done?
Yes. I see these theories of modern physics as a systems view, but applying to non-living matter. What Luisi and I do in our book is the system's view of life, applying it to living systems, living organisms, social systems, and ecosystems.
Well, let's turn to that. You use this phrase, deep ecology, referring to interdependence in your systems theory. How do we understand this from what others call shallow ecology?
Well, the contrast is that, and this goes back to the Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss, who coined this distinction in the mid-70s, and he said that shallow ecology is anthropocentric. We value nature insofar as it is useful to us. So a tree, for instance, has value because we can turn it into timber and make furniture out of it, and we can assign a monetary value to the tree. Deep ecology respects a tree as a living organism, a living being, among a whole network of other living beings, including ourselves. So it's a very different attitude toward nature.
And if you alter one aspect of the system, then you fundamentally are altering the system itself.
Yes, that is correct. And this is why systemic thinking and the system's view of life are so important for solving the major problems we have today. Because systems thinking tells us that these problems are all interconnected, whether we talk about health, poverty, the economy, climate change, management of organizations, or whatever problems we have in the world today, they are systemic problems, that is, they are fundamentally interconnected and interdependent. And only with this kind of systemic perspective will we be able to solve them. And I should say that we devote 200 pages of the book, the whole last part, to this issue, to diagnose the systemic problems of our time and to review already existing systemic solutions.
Let's go over some of those. Obviously, we've got issues related to the environment, which are connected to how we produce energy, produce food, economy.
Let me just give you one example, and I think it can illustrate it very well. And the example is agriculture. Today, we have largely a system of chemical, large-scale industrial agriculture. And if we were to shift to a system of organic, community-oriented, and sustainable farming, this would be a systemic solution because it would contribute significantly to solving three of our biggest problems. And that's characteristic of systemic solution. One solution solves several problems. So in the case of agriculture, it would greatly reduce our energy dependence. So, you know, sustainable agriculture or agroecology doesn't have large energy inputs, whereas now we are using about 20% of our fossil fuels to grow and process food. So huge energy savings. Secondly, the healthy organically grown food would have a huge positive effect on public health because many of our chronic diseases, such as heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and so on, are linked to our diet. And finally, and this is not so well known yet, organic farming would contribute significantly to fighting climate change. Why? Because an organic soil is a carbon-rich soil, which means that it draws CO2 from the atmosphere and locks it up in organic matter. Technically, this is known as carbon sequestration. It's an organic carbon sequestration. So we have one solution solving or contributing to solving three major problems.
In terms of solving the food generation problem, in terms of having enough food for people, do you think that organic farming can do this?
Absolutely. There have been many, many tests, and let me just mention one, which actually is not in our book because there are other tests mentioned in our book, but this one I came across recently, and that's from the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania. They have carried out the longest comparative test between organically grown food and conventionally chemically grown food, and over 23 years. And they find that in normal years, the yields are equal. But in drought years, of which we're going to have many, many more with climate change, in drought years, the organically grown yields are about 30% higher. So the story that we need chemical agriculture to produce more food is absolutely misleading. I should also say, and this we discuss in the book at some length, that the connection between world hunger and the amount of food is really a myth. Hunger is not caused by a lack of food. Hunger is caused mostly by a lack of access to food. So it's a political problem. It's a problem of power. There are many nations in the global south where people go hungry and yet they export food because large corporations sit there and grow food to export to Europe and other countries of the north. So what we need to change is not a change in technology to feed people, but a change in politics and change in power relations.
Let's talk a bit about growth. You talk about this contrast between the kind of growth that is inherent in life and in systems and the kind of growth that tends to be a little bit more destructive.
Yeah, well, let me link this to our previous conversation when I said that the major problems of our time are closely interconnected. I studied these interconnections very carefully, and in the book I actually produced a graph that shows these interconnections of world problems. And I found that at the basis, the fundamental dilemma underlying all these problems seems to be the illusion that unlimited growth is possible on a finite planet. And you would think that this is obvious, that we can't grow indefinitely on a finite planet. But still, most of our economists and politicians hang on to this illusion. And of course, this economic and corporate growth are the driving forces of global capitalism. They are pursued relentlessly by promoting excessive consumption and a throwaway economy that is energy and resource intensive. And so waste is generated, pollution is generated, resources are depleted, and so on. So what is the solution? Well, many people say we have to get away from growth and we can't grow. But no growth is not the answer, because growth is a central characteristic of all life. And you see, here is where systems thinking comes in again. When we observe nature, we see that everything grows, but everything doesn't grow all the time. And so in nature, certain parts of organisms or ecosystems grow, but others decline. And when they decline, they release and recycle their components, which become resources for new growth. And this kind of balanced, multifaceted growth is well known to biologists and ecologists. And this is what I call qualitative growth, to contrast it with the concept of quantitative growth that is used by economists. What we need to do, we need to very concretely look at economic growth and which things in our economy should grow and which things should not grow. And when we do that, then we see that most of what is called growth today is waste, which means that we have an economics largely of waste and destruction. And we need growth that enhances the quality of life. That's what I call qualitative growth. So we could go through various industries and ask, is their growth good growth or is it bad growth? Good growth would be growth that uses no toxic chemicals, that uses renewable resources, that does not waste energy, that does not deplete resources because of constant recycling, and so on. Sort of very much like in ecosystems. The bad growth would be growth using toxics and poisons, fossil fuels, that wastes energy, wastes material, creates destruction of the environment, and so on. And so then we could shift gradually, at least, from bad growth, phasing out industries that should not grow, and shifting the materials, energies, human resources to the industries that should grow. And that is what I call qualitative growth.
Finally, let's take a look at the connection that you've made between consciousness, mind, and matter. how can we understand this in your systems theory?
Well, this is, to me, one of the most exciting and most radical results and achievements of the systems view of life. In the traditional view, as I said before, mind is thought as being separate from matter, and Descartes called the mind the thinking thing, res cogitans in Latin. And ever since Descartes, scientists and philosophers continue to think of the mind as a thing, and we're not able to figure out how this thinking thing relates to matter, the other things in the world. Now, the decisive advance of the systems view of life has been to abandon this Cartesian imagery and to recognize that mind and consciousness are not things, but processes. And in the book, we go into quite some detail of this. Technically, this is known as the Santiago theory of cognition, which sees cognition, the process of knowledge, as closely associated with the very process of life. And so the relationship then between mind and matter would be a relationship between process and structure. In the brain, for example, mind and consciousness are processes, neurophysiological processes, and the brain is the structure through which these processes manifest themselves and take place. But I must tell you that this theory is very sophisticated, and so we would need, you know, at least another half hour to go into some detail.
One of your early books, The Tao of Physics, integrated the ideas that were and the findings that were coming out of theoretical physics and quantum theory with Eastern philosophy. How do we see these two connected?
Well, what turns out is that this, what we now call the systems view of life, of seeing reality in terms of interconnected processes, in terms of relationships, in terms of patterns, is very much the worldview of what sometimes is called the perennial philosophy, the worldview of spiritual traditions or mystical traditions, both in the East and in the West. I started out almost 40 years ago comparing the concepts of modern physics to the basic ideas in Eastern spiritual traditions, but since then I've also made the same comparison with Western mystical traditions, and not only with physics but with the other sciences. And in fact, in the book we have a whole chapter on science and spirituality where we talk about these comparisons.
And you've gone on in your book to talk about these nonlinear living systems, that nonlinearity is a key in living systems. What exactly does that mean to them?
Nonlinearity and more specifically networks. Networks, of course, are intrinsically nonlinear. And so in the 1980s, there was great interest in these nonlinear systems, and several people studied living networks. And that was the first big advance, that they found that there is a key characteristic that we can emphasize in living networks to the point where we can say that's really the definition of biological life, and that is that these living networks are self-generating. In a cell, for example, the simplest living system, the cellular network generates all the structures in the cell. The food, the simple molecules come in through the cell membrane, and then the proteins, the lipids, the membranes, the DNA, all these complex structures are built by the cellular network. And they contribute to the cellular network and are formed by the cellular network at the same time. So living systems are self-generating, and that is the key characteristic.
This is what you say distinguishes life from non-living entities.
Right. And it's quite a clear-cut distinction, although there are always, borderline cases. By the way, technically, this is known as the theory of autopoiesis, which means self-making. And it was created by two Chilean biologists, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. And so this autopoiesis now lets us say that, for instance, a computer is not a living system because a computer does not build itself. It can maybe to some extent repair itself if it's programmed in the right way, but it does not build its components. The same with a virus. A virus actually does replicate, but only within a cell, and it uses the machinery of the cell to replicate. So the virus plus the cell are a living system, but the virus alone is not.
And in this context, what is death?
If we see a living system as a living network in which all these processes are interconnected, and if we see a multicellular system as consisting of cells that also form a network, then we can see that, in at least in complex organisms like ourselves, as we age, some of these connections don't function so well anymore and others are completely interrupted. And the more connections are interrupted, you know, the older the organism is. And at some stage, these interruptions are so strong that the whole system is no longer viable. So death in this systems way is really a fragmentation of components.
That would then go back to the issue of the components within the whole. We've been looking at systems theory as thinking in wholes rather than parts, but the parts do also matter.
Right. And you see, the question of death is very intriguing because one characteristic of living networks is that they not only create their own components, but they continually recycle the components. So if a molecule, you know, does not function very well anymore, if it gets injured in some way, it's being recycled. And this recycling is a very, very intrinsic part of life. So a cell continually recycles its molecules, and a multicellular organism recycles the cells. And without this recycling, biological life would not be possible. But now think of a multicellular organism and the cells. If you shift to the level of the individual cells, this recycling process is a process of life and death, or of death and rebirth. And so death is really not the opposite of life, but it's really part of life at a higher level. And I think philosophically, that's a very intriguing insight.
Thank you again for being with us on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Fritjof Capra is a theoretical physicist who has authored The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, and his latest, The Systems View of Life.
You've been listening to part one of a two-part discussion with Fritjof Capra about his book, The Systems View of Life. Please tune in next week for part two.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.